welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, and today we're going to be talking about the use of sodium glucose transporter 2, or SGLT2 inhibitors, in combination with insulin therapy in patients with type 1 diabetes. Now, although the SGLT2 inhibitors are not FDA approved for use in patients with type 1 diabetes, given their novel mechanism of action, there's been widespread interest in their use in combination with insulin. A study recently published in December 2017 in the New England Journal of Medicine reported the findings from a large phase 3 clinical trial using sotagliflozin with intensive insulin therapy in patients with type 1 diabetes. Sotagliflozin, at the time of this podcast, is not yet approved by the FDA, but it's anticipated that it might become the fifth SGLT2 inhibitor to hit the market. So joining me today is Diana Isaacs from the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Isaacs and her colleague, Rebecca Krupski, wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled, Using an SGLT2 Inhibitor in Tandem with Insulin, Weighing the Benefits and Risks in Type 1 Diabetes. So Diana, thanks for joining us today for the iFormRx podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks so much for the invitation.
So before we get started, I want you to imagine you're seeing RG, a 19-year-old African-American overweight female who has type 1 diabetes and uses an insulin pump. She was diagnosed with diabetes about 5 years ago, and otherwise, she's relatively healthy. She's not had any complications related to diabetes and has never been hospitalized. After using multiple daily injections for several years, the patient was switched to an insulin pump last year in order to achieve better control. And the patient's A1C over the past year has ranged between 7.9% and 8.7%. Today, her A1C measured using a point-of-care device is 8.3%. You're seeing the patient for the first time. RG states that she experiences occasional episodes of hypoglycemia, typically 2 to 3 times per week. She cannot discern a pattern to these episodes, and she always gets symptoms when her blood glucose is less than 70 milligrams per deciliter. She checks her blood glucose 3 to 4 times a day and gives herself a bolus dose based on blood glucose readings as well as anticipated carb intake, but admits that she's not that good about carb counting. Looking at the data from her glucometer, which you've downloaded, you see that most of her readings are in the 150 to 200 range, with some readings occasionally above 250 and a few that are below 70. There's no obvious pattern to the highs or the lows. RG is a freshman in the local community college and lives at home with her parents. And she states that she's trying to lose weight and recently joined the Women's Intramural Softball League at school. So before we start talking about the study that you reviewed for iFormRx, can you tell us a little bit about what's going through your mind in this case? What additional information might you want to collect and assess during the encounter? And what are some of the options you'd be considering at this point?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of kind of my thought process and some of the additional information I'd like to collect, you know, you said this patient is overweight and is trying to lose weight. So I would just want more specifics about that. You know, what is her actual body weight and her body mass index? How much weight does she really need to lose to be considered healthy? I'd also wondering about insulin resistance and if she has that and what her current insulin dose is. So you also mentioned there were no hospitalizations. That indicates to me that likely there have been no severe episodes of hypoglycemia or diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA. But I would just want to confirm that, especially things like if she needed glucagon in the past or maybe had some near episodes of DKA. And then I would want to kind of further clarify what is meant by not being that good about counting carbs. So specifically, has she received diabetes education on carbohydrate counting? Is she actually entering the carbs into her pump? Can she read the food labels? Does she know where to look up the nutrition information and those types of things? And then I'm also kind of wondering, you know, are there any diabetes related complications? So she hasn't had diabetes that long, so most likely not, but also especially wanting to know what her current blood pressure is. And then some other things I'd want to know, you know, looking at her, I'd want to know her insulin pump settings to see if they're, you know, we can optimize those. It sounds like her, you know, her fasting may be running kind of high if it's in the 150 to 200 range. So there may be some room for improvement there. Hearing that she's 19 and in college, I definitely would want to ask about alcohol use because we know that can contribute to some of the lows that patients with type 1 diabetes can experience. And then just more information about the type of insulin pump she's on, if she's using a continuous glucose monitor, if she's using the newer hybrid closed loop system, or if she's eligible for one. And then if she's got any other risk factors for DKA, like how often she's checking her blood glucose, the type of diet she's trying to do to lose weight, like is she trying to follow a very low-carb diet or ketogenic diet? And, you know, I do worry about something called diabulimia where patients may omit insulin doses to lose weight. So just would want to make sure those behavior things aren't happening. And then also just being that she's 19, asking about contraception. And then in terms of options to consider at this point, I would say definitely diabetes education is always my go-to, especially for the carbohydrate counting. I would also say a dietitian consult for healthy weight loss. I'd be looking at what type of insulin pump adjustments we could be doing, continuous glucose monitoring if that's not being done already, and then considering the hybrid closed-loop insulin pump. So that's kind of the things I'm thinking so far about this case.
So, Diana, if you had to briefly summarize in just a few sentences the study entitled Sotagliflozin Added to Insulin in Patients with Type 1 Diabetes, more affectionately known as the InTandem 3 study, to someone who hasn't read the paper, what would you say?
Yeah, so this study evaluated sotagliflozin, which is actually a novel SGLT1 and SGLT2 inhibitor. And so SGLT1 actually acts on glucose absorption in the GI tract, and that increases the release of GLP-1 and polypeptide YY, which actually contributes to some of the weight loss benefits. And then additionally, we of course have the SGLT2 inhibition, which prevents glucose reabsorption by the kidney. So it is a novel new agent, a little bit different than our other SGLT2 inhibitors. In terms of the study, it was with 1,402 patients with type 1 diabetes who were receiving treatment with insulin therapy, either on an insulin pump or on multiple daily injections. And they were randomized to either receive sotagliflozin 400 milligrams per day or placebo for 24 weeks. And the primary endpoint was a hemoglobin A1C of less than 7% at week 24 with no episodes of severe hypoglycemia or diabetic ketoacidosis. And then in terms of secondary endpoints, that included changes in blood pressure, weight, hemoglobin A1C, and the mean daily dose of insulin. So the results of the study showed a statistically significant improvement in the sotagliflozin group. So there were actually 200 of the 699 patients randomized to that group, which was 28.6%, reached that primary endpoint, compared to only 107 of 703 in the placebo group, which was 15.2%. And then the treatment group also experienced statistically significant reductions in the A1C, weight, and systolic blood pressure and total insulin dose compared to placebo. However, there were higher rates of DKA in the sotagliflozin group. In total, there were 21 events, which was 3% compared to just 4 events or 0.6% in those in the placebo group. And there were more events on the insulin pump group, actually 4.4%.
So, Diana, what do you believe are the key strengths and weaknesses of this study? Are there any potential confounders present in the study? And what would be the impact on the results from those confounders?
So, strengths include that it's a large sample size. It was multi-centered, randomized, placebo-controlled. The baseline characteristics were pretty well matched between both groups. And I would say a pretty good real-world population. 70% of the patients included were overweight. The average age was 42 and 43. The average A1C was 8.2%. Nearly half of them were female, and the duration of diabetes was for about 20 years. So very similar to the types of patients I'm seeing that struggle with A1C lowering and type 1 diabetes. So in terms of some of the limitations, the trial, was only conducted over 24 weeks. So it does put into question the true safety, the long-term efficacy of sotagliflozin. Also, there was very strict criteria to define hypoglycemia, which could have missed many events. And then there was a very rigorous protocol for detection and treatment of DKA, where patients were very well educated on the treatment and prevention. And even with that, there was still way more episodes of DKA in the treatment group. So one may be a little concerned about how this would apply to real life. And if we use this in kind of our everyday encounters, would we see even higher rate of DKA? And then in terms of confounders, so the study investigators were actually blinded to the A1C. So that could just potentially limit more aggressive treatment. Their patients were allowed to use continuous glucose monitors, but that data was not analyzed at all in terms of the study. And then just kind of something that to take into consideration, at the time of this study, there was no artificial pancreas type of systems yet. There wasn't the hybrid closed loop pump system. And so now that those are available and the technology is improving, that of course is going to kind of impact how we treat patients with type 1 diabetes.
So I think many clinicians are wondering what the place of sotagliflozin or any of the other SGLT2 inhibitors might be in patients with type 1 diabetes. I mean, theoretically, there's no need to add a SGLT2 inhibitor to achieve better glycemic control because we can simply adjust the insulin therapy to get the goal. What do you see are the primary advantages of using an SGLT2 inhibitor and potentially the primary disadvantages, obviously DKA being one of them, but there may be others. Would you consider adding one of these in a case like RGs? And would you think that this data will change clinical practice guidelines in some way?
So in terms of the advantages, sotagliflozin has a unique mechanism of action. And we clearly saw from the trial, it has the ability to help patients achieve A1C goal in those struggling on their insulin regimen alone. It also has the ability to decrease weight and blood pressure and total daily dose of insulin. And another, this is, I guess, a theoretical advantage, but we know like with empagliflozin and canagliflozin, we've seen some cardiovascular benefits. And so there's that potential that sotagliflozin could have that as well if we study it more long-term. Now, in terms of disadvantages, it's clear there is that increased risk of DKA, which can be a life-threatening complication. So that is very worrisome. There are also other adverse effects that we see with SGLT2 inhibitors, and that includes the genital mycotic infections. And then specifically, because this one has SGLT1 inhibition, there's also some gastrointestinal adverse effects like diarrhea and nausea. Being that this was a shorter 24-week study, we don't know about some of the longer-term effects. So like we know that with canagliflozin, we've seen increased risk of amputations and bone fractures. And so we don't have enough information to see if this drug would cause similar types of adverse effects. And then of course, when you add a drug, you have a higher cost. SGLT2 inhibitors are pretty expensive and you're just adding more medications, which can potentially impact adherence. So in terms of would we use it in RG, I think probably not at this time. Technically, she does meet the inclusion criteria of the study. However, her demographics are pretty different from the baseline characteristics that were in the study. So, being that she's 19 years old, I feel that she has a higher risk of DKA just due to things like dieting, potential alcohol use, an unpredictable schedule. And I've seen in this patient population, sometimes the frequency of blood glucose monitoring is not as often as I would like. She's only had diabetes for 5 years, and in the study, patients had diabetes for 20 years on average. Especially since she's only 19, she likely does not need the blood pressure lowering effects of it, although that would be, additional information to collect. And then technically, we don't know the long-term cardiovascular benefits or risks of this drug at this time. The other things I would add is for a 19-year-old college student, I actually think she's doing quite well. I know her A1C goal is not where we would like it, she's 8.3%. However, I think there's a lot we can do at this point with diabetes education, especially related to that carbohydrate counting and seeing a dietitian for healthy weight loss. And definitely, I think there's a lot of benefits with the CGM or continuous glucose monitoring if she's not already using that. And then I have seen a lot of success with the hybrid closed loop insulin pump. And there's a lot of newer technology that's really coming up likely in the next year or two. So I think that is very promising and maybe a better approach at this point. However, the technology does require carbohydrate counting. So she's still going to, that's still going to really be a priority for her at this time. And then your other question about, will this change clinical practice guidelines? So I think this actually, this does have the potential to change guidelines. I see patients in my clinic all the time that are really struggling with their weight and wide glucose fluctuations. And even with the insulin pump technology, even with it improving, insulin pumps are not for everyone. And at this point in time, even with the hybrid closed loop systems, we still have a long way to go to really perfect this technology. And so I would really love to see there be other options available for patients, especially because we only have one adjunctive agent available currently, which is pramlintide. And that has many limitations. It requires multiple daily injections. It also has the gastrointestinal side effects. And there's somewhat limited A1C lowering. I am concerned about the risk of DKA, and this is something that would require extensive education for both the patient and provider, especially because with SGLT2 inhibitors, we've seen euglycemic DKA, where glucose may not be that elevated. And so it's important to educate on recognizing the symptoms. There was a previous study done with dapagliflozin that showed when insulin reduction was limited to 20%, that really reduced the episodes of DKA. So that is something, you know, that could be a potential education point for providers that may help reduce some of those episodes.
Well, Diana, thank you so very much for joining us today to discuss the InTandem 3 study and the use of sotagliflozin as well as potentially other SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with type 1 diabetes. I think it's clear from your comments that you believe there may be some role for these agents, but there's lots of new technology that's evolving in the delivery of insulin, which also help us to take better care of patients with type 1 diabetes. Well, tell us what you think. Is there a role for SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with type 1 diabetes? And if so, when would you use them? And how would you safeguard against the development of ketoacidosis? Well, remember, only iForumRx members can leave comments and access our growing list of resource pages. You can become a member of iForumRx. It's free. Sign up today and be sure to sign in every time you visit. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iForumRx, signing off.